Welcome back to the program. I'm Charles Lee.
And
for Grok Science,
that's Mike Lee.
And coming in from Taipei, I'm Angelica Ong.
And coming in from Chicago, I'm Emmanuel Sheikh.
Oh yeah, I probably should have said where I was. I'm from Baton Rouge right now.
How's the food there? Do you guys get beignets?
Oh, you know about our beignets. Yes, it's fantastic. You just missed Mardi Gras season, so it was king cakes now.
Ooh, my goodness. Well, I've never been, but it's on my list for sure. I have to pay you a visit, Charles.
Okay, I don't know if you know about the king cake tradition, right? Which is, there's a little plastic baby baked into the cake.
Yes, and you have baby. Do you get good luck for the whole year?
If you get the baby, you're supposed to bring the king cake to the next party.
Oh, no way.
Well, I guess that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not sure, but...
Oh, wow. Okay. So it's like the ring, but delicious.
Yeah. Well, you're all welcome to come down to Baton Rouge for Mardi Gras season. Laissez les bons temps brûler.
Awesome. I just might take you up on that.
All right. Well, I guess we do talk about science, but I know we were jumping at the bit last time, and Angelica, you had a story, I remember.
Well, you know, just to reintroduce myself real quick again, I'm Angelica, and I am a clean energy activist and reporter from Taipei, Taiwan, where I work to push for Taiwan to keep using nuclear energy. Today's topic actually has a little bit to do with nuclear energy, but not the kind that you might think. So a few weeks ago, a Chinese startup called BetaVolts came out with a press release saying that they have a tiny radioactive battery that could keep producing power for basically years and years. It instantly, of course, got everybody thinking, wow, does this mean we never have to recharge our cell phone batteries again? And in fact, it's not like that, but we can have a little discussion about radioactive batteries, which have been a thing in science, whether or not it could be a thing in our lives in the future. So I would like to talk about that.
And so these are batteries that are emitting radioactive particles?
Well, probably don't want to put those in kids' toys.
Literally, the radioactive batteries have actually had a really long history. So they were developed in the 50s and 60s, mostly for military and space applications. So in the beginning, they were just the kind of batteries that's used in things like the Curiosity rover, like the Voyager probe. They're going into space and you want them to keep going, right? Because they can never get recharged. Those are called radioisotope thermoelectric generators, or RTGs. And the way that works is you use heat from radioactive decay, you put it next to a thermocouple, heating it up, and that heat gradient is what causes the current to flow from a radioactive source, such as plutonium-238 or strontium-90. That's really good for things like, for instance, the Voyager. We're still getting data from that because that is just going to keep running. In fact, it's kind of a misnomer to call it a battery because the energy isn't stored. It's being constantly produced by the stream of radioactive decay, generate electricity for years or even decades. But the problem is with RTGs is that they're big and they're bulky and they're super expensive. So for the Curiosity rover, the RTG costs $109 million. Of course, that's like a huge endeavor and it needs to produce a lot of electricity, 125 watts, and it weighs 45 kilograms. Converting through heat is, in fact, kind of relatively inefficient. So new startup concept is not a RTG battery. It uses another technology. So you guys all know solar panels, right? They produce power through photovoltaic concept. And just like a photon striking a piece of silicon can produce electricity. So we can do that with alpha, beta, and gamma particles. And I think we figured out why this startup is called BetaVolts. It's because they use beta particles to produce these electricity. So it's really exciting. The choice of source they're using, which is nickel-3, and the Chinese companies tend to be more opaque. So we are going off a lot their press release. So I can only surmise that beta particles are probably more energetic than the alpha particles. The big breakthrough is that they're layering it very thinly between the source and thin layers of diamonds to act as a semiconductor. And we don't know with photovoltaics, right? It's they're using silica. And the reason why they use diamonds for these beta volts batteries or alpha volts or gamma volt batteries for those radio batteries is that radioactivity is obviously very hard on semiconductors. So diamonds, though, are hard enough to resist degradation. So very thin layers of diamonds and swords, like a teeny, teeny, tiny sandwich. And the resultant battery is actually about the size of a coin. So it's really, really tiny. So obviously, everybody's imagination is set on fire. But we do have to bring things down to earth a little bit, which is that even with this breakthrough in energy density and output, we are still talking about 100 microwatts and 3 volts. And if you look at the average cell phone, like the one that we all carry in our pockets every day, that's really more like 3 to 4 watts. And so we really need thousands of those little batteries to actually power a cell phone. So we're very, very far from going down to our local store and picking up a radio battery and never have to worry about charging our phones again. But I still think that this is a really, really exciting development and a reminder that really call like nuclear science, nuclear engineering, it's like the infinite energy glitch. Obviously, we do understand how it works, but it is so much more powerful than a chemical source of energy storage or physical source of energy storage that I'm really looking forward to the future. I wonder what kind of breakthroughs could come.
My colleague did some calculations, and it was something like you need a 1 liter volume of this material, this nickel material, to produce 1 watt of electricity. So it's not very energy dense, but for like a hearing aid where you only need microwatts, that may actually be a reasonable power source.
Yeah, absolutely. And oh, by the way, talking about Back to the Future, you know, like it's all, a lot of the concept. People did actually use radioactive batteries for pacemakers. So imagine you need a tiny, tiny pulse of electricity, but you need it to be very stable and you need it to last for years and years and years. And those would be a once-in-a-lifetime charge. You just put that radio battery in your pacemaker, in your body, and that lasted until the end of your life. So I don't think they do that anymore. They use a different type of battery now, but they did use that for many years.
There was the danger of the radiation turning the patient into the Hulk, you know, so that was always a...
Yeah, I love the phrase infinite energy glitch. I'm going to start using that.
All right. Well, Iman, did you have a story as well?
Yes, probably based on my background, I tend to gravitate towards the most speculative and sort of bizarre in science. And so a story that caught my eye was that some scientists are working on gene editing for some viruses, but they propose that hacking these viruses might help us fight climate change. So they're engineering microbes in order to create climate solutions. So this got me really interested, and I kind of started looking into the background of, I know quite a bit about geohacking and climate hacking, speculative stuff. It's not super old, right? Like maybe 50 years or so. But then with the advance of gene editing and CRISPR, which is another thing that's been happening, I mean, we just recently got, I mean, this is another story, but we just recently found out about FDA approval for a CRISPR-based therapy to treat sickle cell. So, I mean, we're having these major advancements in gene editing. To see them come together is what really caught my attention. And it seems that there's a bunch of different ways to do this, but the way that came out in the news recently was that there may be some viruses in ocean water and in Arctic ice, and these viruses can potentially help trap carbon emissions. So they're trying to figure out if we can enhance this ability. So there was a press release out of Ohio State University about this research where scientists are essentially trying to identify some of these viruses and figure out if they could potentially be a tool in the toolbox to mitigate some of the worst effects of climate change. So some of these viruses can trap carbon in seawater, but others can stop methane from leaking out of melting permafrost. So the potential for these microbes to be carbon sinks or just greenhouse gas sinks is really fascinating. And so there was some of this research going on maybe a little bit less than a decade ago where scientists identified these viruses, but now taking it to this like next level of thinking of them as something that could be hacked. I mean, it's quite fascinating scientifically, but I think also just has, as we're sort of coming out of a global pandemic, huge implications for who can control what happens when you essentially edit the genes of a virus, and that you're doing so because you want global scale changes. Curious what you all think about that, you know, in what sense these things can be predicted, especially because to make this even more higher stakes, they're using a lot of AI to do some of the modeling for this work, for this research. And so we have the collision of all of these essentially highly innovative, but also highly speculative sciences, right? We have climate hacking, we have gene editing, we have AI kind of all colliding in this particular project. And my head was just spinning with the potentially transformative possibilities, but also the really scary, you know, implications that could perhaps cascade. To my knowledge, no one's actually doing this yet, but people are just talking about the possibility.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is a double-edged sword, right? Like one example that biologist geophysicist friend suggested was like cyanobacteria, which like sort of the blue-green algae. If you genetically modify so that they absorb a greater bandwidth of the spectrum, potentially in the ocean, that means they could absorb more light, and that would cause the planet to heat up even faster. So we have to be really careful with these types of technologies.
It is perfect storm of things that can be kind of chaotic, right? You may understand each little component, but put them all together. And
yeah, and I think like, on the other hand, there's something potentially exciting about it, right? Because we have these climate seemingly intractable problems, and we have these global summits to try to solve it, and we have all of these policies put in place. But, you know, what if we just could rely on some viruses to like eat up the carbon? I mean, it sounds very elegant as a solution. And I think what's both exciting and problematic about harnessing the power of viruses and the power of AI is because they sort of function like kind of pseudo organisms, right? Like viruses are not quite organisms, not quite not. AI, you know, is this weird, uncanny thing that feels like it's, you know, got its own consciousness, but it doesn't. But both of them can work in ways that exceed our ability to predict them. And even if we put in a particular code for, you know, whether that code is a virus's DNA or RNA, or we're trying to put in code for an algorithm, it's that unpredictability of a dynamic or living system that should make us cautious, I think. So a lot of this geohacking stuff was already on the cusp of being a little too scary, but coupling that with virus editing is something I want to keep my eye on for sure.
I feel like it is one of those solutions that we really don't want to go to just because we can't predict, and it might be hard to contain a self-replicating thing out there in the world. But I think desperate times also calls for desperate measures, and it's something that we should certainly be researching just in case things go out of control and we've got to pull that ripcord. I feel like another one of those things is, well, why don't we just release a whole bunch of stuff into the atmosphere and have it reflect a bunch of sunlight? It's like, we don't really want to go there, but if we do it, it's cheap.
I mean, even on smaller scales, right? Like some of my research about the UAE is that, you know, the UAE is a place that has very, very major water scarcity, right? It's essentially a desert. The Gulf is getting shallower and shallower because it's already shallow. And with the temperature change, with global warming, it's evaporating. So they can't desalinate water fast enough. Their water table under their terrain is shrinking. So they've experimented with cloud seeding, and cloud seeding is one of those like strange sciences that no one's really quite sure if it works or not, right? But they've been working on it. You know, they've got their planes like flying into the clouds, dropping off various kinds of substances, some of them more inert than others, to just get it to rain. But first of all, we don't know if it works. But insofar as it does work, it might be working in ways we can't anticipate. So there's sort of this like tension now between the UAE and some of its neighbors about whether or not it's causing floods. So like if the rains go above the mountainous area over the border with Oman and then they cause floods on the other side, did they cause that? Like rain doesn't respect borders. You can't contain clouds. And that seems like something that should be the domain of one country or whatever, because they're just putting stuff in their own airspace. But these global level hacks, you know, manipulations have a tendency to leak and to exceed the boundaries we place for them. So I think that's just one example. And I, you know, we can see how this would have huge implications for governance. We would need international bodies to manage this kind of work. And we can barely get international bodies to agree on like ocean exploration, even without intervention, right? Just in terms of like exploration or research. And then on top of that, trying to extract resources from the ocean. And so now you're not only trying to extract things from particular bodies of water, but to change the metabolism of that entire ecosystem by altering the most basic smallest organisms within it in ways that affect the climate. I mean, that I think is next level. So an interesting developing story that we can maybe continue to talk about as it comes up again.
Yeah, this reminds me of some of the earlier stories and also some of the stuff that my colleagues have been interested in is the idea of like iron fertilization, right? So for very low cost, spur CO2 removal by catalyzing kelp production by seeding the ocean with iron particles. And so it's been controversial, but it's, at the same time, there seems to be some scientific basis for doing something like that. The example that they cite is that when Mount Pinatubo gave off the stream of minerals into the atmosphere that fell in the ocean, that spurred a one-year removal of CO2, presumably because it had catalyzed these algae to bloom in the ocean. So yeah, it is very interesting to see if that idea can really be realized or not. So, but at the same time, there could be, you know, I guess we need to be judicious as well, right? Are there side effects that we're not anticipating?
With a lot of these technologies, they are becoming so available and that so much concern about state agents, but it's those rogue agents that are able to.
Yeah, the problem is it's like a Pandora's box, right? I feel like with a lot of these things, if you try to constrain your own development, then you're just giving more power for the people who are not as scrupulous as you, because they know how to do it. Once it's known that it can be done, it's hard to put that genie back in the bottle. We need to be cautious, and you know, we need to work on how to minimize the risk. But I don't think there's any stopping the progress. I think we have to progress through the progress, and that's really scary. Of course, I mean, I think we all need to talk about AI risk. Maybe eventually in another episode. The problem is there's so many actors in the world, and who are you to tell another sovereign country that they can't develop AI? And you know that if you don't, they will.
Yeah, it's mutually assured destruction, which we all lived through in the 80s, or at least those of us who were around in the 80s remember. What was the source of this story, Iman?
So this was I read it on futurism.com, but I know that it came out of Ohio State University press release, February 17th. So viruses that can help dial up carbon capture in the sea, the press release out of Ohio State on the 17th. So you can find that on the Ohio State News website.
Well, you know, I feel like I learned something else. I didn't know that viruses were just like floating about in the ocean. I always associated them with being inside of a larger organism. Guess they can just float around too.
Yeah, I think estimating like one square meter of air, there's about half a trillion viruses floating at any time.
Or what?
Yeah, it's a very large number.
I'm gonna have to check your source on that one. We'll have to look that one.
No, I read it because I was doing some stuff for aerosols a couple years ago. So doing what kind of particulates were in the air. So that was the number I got, but
we're running out of time, but I have so many questions. Like, wow.
Maybe we can bring in a virologist in a future episode to talk us through all of these topics.
If you have questions for Frank, you can be sure to email them. Science@grox.net is our emails. Send your questions in and Any questions also you want us to look into, perhaps, from people about things they want us to talk about?
Yes, especially feel free to send us any weird or speculative science, because you know I'll be all over that.
And I'll be answering all your nuclear and nuclear-related questions.
Roundup of some interesting science events during the week, so...
And that's all for this week's edition.
Well, for Grox, I was Charles Lee.
I'm Frank Ling from Tokyo.
I'm Angelica Ong from Taiwan.
And I'm Emmanuel Sheikh from Chicago. Thank you.
If you'd like to contact us here, you can email us at science@grox.net.
You should also see us on the web at www.grox.net. Have a great afternoon and keep on grokking.